Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4th of July sale and get 30% off paints and stains June 26th through July 6th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only, some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
This is Kid in a Cage.
Florida versus Timothy Ferriter.
A father accused of locking his adopted son inside a cage. Join us as we hear the facts behind these charges
through live courtroom audio from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Back in session, the Honorable Judge Howard Coates presiding.
All right, good afternoon, everyone. You may be seated. All right, all sides ready to proceed with the continuation? All right, defense, ready? Okay. All right, you may go ahead and bring the jurors out. All rise.
Jury entering.
All right, everyone may be seated. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. We are in the middle of the direct examination of the current witness. So with that, Ms. Coakley, are you ready to proceed?
Yes.
All right, you may do so.
Now, I want to talk for a second about the impacts that harsh, cruel, demeaning, and injurious treatment of a child can have. Can that have an impact on the child's view of morality?
Yes, it would be an important part of how they learn to be moral, responsible human beings, really, is a big part of that is modeled by your parents. So the modeling he got was certainly had some serious moral problems, in that it's giving him various messages like violence is okay and isolating people is okay and withholding food is okay and being choked is okay, those sort of things. These are the most important role models in your life or your parents.
Can that create a distorted view of what is morally appropriate behavior?
Oh, very much so, yes. After months or years of this, it becomes normal to the child, despite how pathological or abnormal it is. They begin to see this as just normal, a normal part of life.
Now, can that distortion of appropriateness also extend to the child's view of themselves?
Yes, it can. And one of the ways it might do that is that the child internalizes being treated like this and sees themselves as the bad, responsible one with they have the moral problems. It's their fault that this is happening, clearly, because it keeps happening to them. It must they think it must be in some way my fault.
even in situations where there's kind of like pervasive ongoing abuse or trauma inflicted by a parent caregiver, can a child who is subject to that still have affection for the abuser?
Yes, that's very common.
Why does that occur? Or how does that occur, especially in a situation like this?
Some of it is just, it's built into children that if you provide them care and you take care of them and give them a place to live and feed them and get them to school, that sort of thing, the attachment system does kick in and they connect to that person. They form a bond.
So a child can come away from an abusive situation and still have affection or allegiance to the abuser.
Yeah, that's very, very typical.
Now, I want to talk for a second about stealing as something that can occur within a certain, is that something, a behavior that can result in children that have been subject to abuse or neglect?
Yes, you're stealing, you're talking about.
Stealing.
Yes,
yeah.
And particularly in this case, kids who've had that early psychosocial deprivation and really lack of adequate parenting in their first couple of years of life, or year and a half in his case.
Is it when a child is exhibiting that type of behavior, especially when there's a known history of some kind of neglect or abuse, is it therapeutic or appropriate treatment to address that behavior to deprive the child of access to some of the items?
You mean which items?
Like if a child is stealing food or candy, if that is something that occurs and that's something that's been noticed, in order to address that behavior, therapeutically, what would be the appropriate way to address it?
Well, to try to talk to them about it and try to understand and explore their feelings about why this behavior is continuing, and then help them gain insight into the fact that you did have a very difficult early childhood, and kids like that will have this urge to keep hoarding and taking food, because in the back of their brain and at an instinctual survival level, they're thinking, I've got to keep getting food and hoard it, because at any point I could start going hungry again and there'll be nothing to eat. So to help them gain insight and to then give them interventions, or that's too strong of a word, but then to give them regular snacks and reassure them they're always going to be able to get snacks if they start really feeling that anxiety or need to eat something. So not restrict it, but let them know it's always here and make that a reality. Not that you are going to have them eat five Big Macs a day, but you'd have to tailor what sort of meals and snacks you'd let them have.
Can that type of hoarding and inclination and kind of compulsive to get food, can that occur even in children that are otherwise well-fed and maybe not like starving?
who've
had the previous trauma?
Yes, definitely. Yes.
Now, is limiting or severely controlling a child's access to food and snacks and water, is that something that is a therapeutic treatment for this type of behavioral problem?
It's counter-therapeutic. It goes against the treatment because you're teaching them it's true. Those very sort of primitive feelings you have that there's not enough to eat and food may not always be accessible, you're now keeping it a reality instead of helping them get over that insecurity.
And so when you say it's counter-therapeutic, does that mean that it can make the behaviors actually worse?
Yes.
Overall.
Does that mean that it could increase, or would that have what kind of impact would it have on the behaviors?
It reinforces it. It might increase it. It may just keep it, sustain it. It depends on the child, but I would not predict that would make it any better at all.
Now, you mentioned social deprivation and cognitive deprivation. What are those things?
So children really of any age, and probably it's true for adults too, but they need consistent caregiving. They need nurturance. They need support. They need affection. They need to be held or hugged. They need to be shown empathy so that they know that their needs are recognized and being met, so they can develop confidence and emotional security in themselves. So the pathological care would be really the opposite of those things.
What do you mean that, the pathological care?
Well, the kind of parenting that you wouldn't want to see for a child who's come from this sort of early deprivation is care that wouldn't be supportive and consistent and nurturing and affectionate.
The type of care that you saw that occurred between January, that's on the videos, between January 5th and January 28th, will you characterize that as supportive, caring, empathetic care?
No, I would see it as the opposite of those.
Okay, how would you describe it?
Unempathic, mean, frightening, not in any way trying to recognize what's going on with the child, but just for imposing your will in a harsh disciplinary fashion.
Now, Dr. Murray, you're not, I mean, are you saying that like a parent can't yell at a child?
No, not at all.
Are you saying that a parent can't discipline a child if they do something that they behave in a way that's inappropriate?
No, you have to discipline children in an appropriate way, sure, for issues, misbehaviors.
Are you saying that a parent can't punish a child if they do something that requires punishment?
I prefer to use the term discipline. Punishment has somewhat of a negative connotation, but you could look at it as punishment, I suppose, if it's reasonable and mild.
Okay, so what is more appropriate and also developmentally appropriate for a child of this age you would characterize as discipline?
What would
I characterize? Discipline is more appropriate than punishment for a child, a 14-year-old child of this age.
Yes.
What's the difference, I guess, between what is appropriate and then what is harmful?
The simple answer would be what's in the best interest of the child, and is what you're doing, whatever it is it going to help the child learn why this problem is, why their behavior was not good? Is it going to help give them ideas or ways to not engage in this behavior in the future, give them alternatives, to turn it into a learning experience at the same time with enough of discipline that it does get their attention if you think it needs it? I mean, some kids, they get a harsh word from a parent and they're good to go for a year. Other kids need a lot more hands-on intervention. It depends on the child's temperament and personality.
Now, I want to talk about kind of the impact that cognitive deprivation or intellectual deprivation can have on a child's creation of their own identity. How does that impact that?
It's sort of a couple different things, two different things there, but the deprivation has actually been shown in longer-term studies to lower children's IQ, their IQ scores. So their intelligence level doesn't rise as high as somebody who isn't deprived or mistreated over the years.
Now, in cases where children are subject to cognitive deprivation or intellectual deprivation, do you see instances of that child engaging in fantasy or lying? Or can you
yes.
see that?
Yes.
Why does that happen?
Some kids will start engaging in fantasy thinking and makeup stories, and it's a coping mechanism to try to sort of fill the void of having so little mental stimulation or intellectual or cognitive outlets. So they then begin creating their own stories and fantasies to sort of fill that hole.
Now, I want to talk about a child expressing frustration and anger. Is a child expressing frustration and anger the same thing as violence, necessarily?
No, not at all. But violence would be one sliver of children who are frustrated and angry. Some will act violently.
Now, during the course of the review of some of the videos, did you see a few videos where Ronan is expressing inside the room frustration or anger?
Yes. Or a great deal of emotional pain that he doesn't know how else to to release, it seems like, than when he starts just like tearing the posters off the wall or kicking his Legos around.
Now, just generally, outside of the specific facts of this case, is something like kicking Legos or screaming in frustration or tearing posters off the wall, is for a 14-year-old child, is that like a clinically significant type of anger or frustration just in general if a 14-year-old does that?
In and of itself, that's not necessarily a pathological or a behavior or some sign of serious mental illness. If it's infrequent and the child has really had a terribly frustrating experience or something, they might come home and kick something on the floor. But no, in and of itself, no.
Could it be a completely normal expression of frustration or anger in a 14-year-old boy?
It could be, yes.
To react to maybe some kind of adverse experience or just whatever frustration it is?
Yes.
Now, in this type of situation, does that Ronan being in that situation, locked in the room alone and having that type of response, does that tell you anything about how he's dealing with the trauma of the situation?
Well, he's only got a limited number of things he can do with all this angst and emotional pain and the effects of this mistreatment building up and building up. It's got to come out somehow. It always comes out one way or another in human beings. And it seems like in him, the only sort of outlets he's really got are to kind of throw things around or kick whatever's in the room that's left. He did become suicidal a couple times from it as well.
So the only...
Which would be another way that you could get those sort of feelings, unfortunately, a method to get those out or deal with them.
So in the room itself, the only control he has is over the immediate items in the room.
Sustained. Rephrase, counsel.
In the room itself, what does he have the capacity or the agency to control?
What did he have?
Yeah, about his physical environment.
Well, very little, because he's in a box, and essentially the only other things in there are a bed and a sheet and a pillow and a desk, and I believe towards the end again one book.
Now, at some point, there might be some discussion in this case about more specific situations when a child has more specific behavioral needs than an ordinary child, or. And we might discuss reactive attachment disorder. Are you familiar with what that is?
Oh, yes, I am.
What is it?
It's a diagnosis, a condition where a child is deprived, usually during the first 2 or 3 years at least of their life and earlier, of consistent, supportive, appropriate parenting. So they don't have regular nurturance or contact with a caregiver, a parent. So they don't have the chance to sort of form secure attachments to a parent or two, which is what they're programmed to do.
And then, so something has to occur, just so I'm understanding you correctly, something has to occur early in life that makes it difficult for that where they weren't able to form an attachment.
Well, yes, they're not having a responsive, tender care. They're being left alone for long periods of time. When they are fed, it might just be with a bottle a few times a day. Otherwise, they're left laying there unattended or with very little stimulation, and this results in their brain not developing properly, emotional system not developing properly, even physically they don't grow as well, and moreover their head size isn't even necessarily as big as the size that you would that it should be.
Now, in a child who does have an attachment disorder, is a child with this disorder necessarily violent towards themselves or others? Is that like something that always happens?
That's not actually a diagnostic criteria for reactive attachment disorder. Violence is not even one of the defining criteria or criterion of that.
Is there generally accepted, if a child does have some type of attachment disorder and specifically reactive attachment disorder, is there generally accepted therapeutic interventions within the scientific community to address that?
The main treatment that has been shown to to work is to get the child out of the problematic, uncaring environment, the pathological environment, as quick as possible, and put them with either a foster family or a stable relative, or have them adopted into a good parenting situation. I mean, that's the treatment, and get them back on a normal course of development.
And so we're talking about a good parenting situation. Do you mean stable, nurturing, that addresses the child's needs?
Yes.
Now,
that works, and the majority of children with RAD, reactive attachment disorder, have substantially diminished or even resolution of their RAD symptoms over time.
Is it considered therapeutically acceptable or appropriate to isolate, confine, or deprive a child who might have a history that lends them to having an attachment disorder?
No, it's just what you wouldn't want to do to a child with reactive attachment disorder, because that isolation and lack of contact and lack of affection are the things that created it in the first place. So you want to undo that by doing the opposite to the child with good parenting.
Would it exacerbate any attachment issues if they were there to treat a child like Ronan Farrator was treated?
Yes, it would. Yes, it wouldn't. Yes, simple answer.
Now, what about a child? You mentioned that, you know, in your opinion, there were some indications that there was a complex post-traumatic stress disorder indicated here.
Yes.
Would this type of treatment in any way address or help a child with post-traumatic stress disorder?
Well, no. I believe that's the cause of him having post-traumatic stress disorder is the abusive treatment that he received.
Now, would this type of treatment worsen the behavior or increase symptoms?
Yes.
Now, did you, as part of this case, have the opportunity to review a deposition given by a Dr. Rapa?
I did.
And she made some opinions about this case as well, correct?
She did, yes.
Did you agree with any of the opinions that Dr. Rapa made?
I did. In particular, she did describe the behaviors that Ronan was experiencing and the punishment, the isolation, the abuse as inappropriate and unacceptable. She referred to Ronan having complex post-traumatic stress disorder, partly from his experiences in Vietnam when he was in the orphanage, but I don't believe that would really add up, because PTSD is from being traumatized, be it physical abuse or a car accident or being caught in a hurricane or whatever it might be, or seeing something terrible happen to a family member. But being neglected and left alone doesn't cause post-traumatic stress disorder. So I saw nothing in the records that he had experienced any early traumas in his first couple of years of life when he was in Vietnam, year and a half.
So you would be in agreement with Dr. Rapa that there are indicators that the victim in this case has experienced trauma?
Definitely, yes.
But the source of that trauma is a little bit of a disagreement, if I'm understanding you correctly.
If I'm understanding her deposition correctly, yes.
But would you agree with her opinion that regardless of the source of the trauma, this is not the way that a child with PTSD should be treated?
Well, right, because you're continuing to inflict the trauma on the child, and the PTSD comes from the trauma, so you're just doing nothing but worsening the child's PTSD with more and more of the same traumatic experiences.
I think we talked about, in general, a child, that this would be harmful. If a child has specific, because of their history, has behavioral issues or maybe even a medical diagnosis, does that change whether or not this is an appropriate type of punishment for a child?
I can't come up with any kind of explanation that would justify the treatment Ronan went through is appropriate.
The fact that there might be indications that because of his history and because of his treatment that he was, you know, vulnerable or psychologically complex, does that increase the risk to him psychologically to be subjected to this type of treatment?
Yes, above and beyond being especially vulnerable given he is a child, yes, that would even increase the risk more.
That's all the questions I have.
Qualls?
Good afternoon, Doctor.
Good afternoon.
Let me start with I have your list of testimony in cases, civil and criminal. It's a pretty extensive list. You've testified in Palm Beach County before, correct?
Yes.
And looks like all but one defendant all were for the state. Is that correct?
I haven't reviewed it, but I'll take your word for it.
I'm happy to have you review it if you want.
I trust you.
All right. And can you tell me what you're being compensated for your testimony here today?
I'm sorry?
How much are you being compensated for your testimony?
I'm being compensated for my time, but $350 an hour.
All right. And how much time have you put into the preparation of your testimony here today? Approximately.
Preparation for testimony?
I'm going to break it down. Yes, testimony.
I would say in the neighborhood of 5 hours.
All right. And in addition to that, any other preparation that you did, how much time did you put in?
Reviewing the records, I have a sheet on my office desk. I'm going to estimate it's probably in the ballpark of probably 8 hours, 9 hours of record review to get through all the materials, which I tried to reread as much as I could in the last day or two. Because there's a lot of information.
Yeah, and we'll get to what you reviewed in a minute, but I appreciate your answer. I'm looking at your CV, very extensive, thick CV, because it has all the publications that you wrote, plus those which you've contributed to, correct?
Yes.
I'm going to go through a few here. I noticed, going back a little ways, in 94 you wrote one called Sexual Homicide by Adolescents.
Yes.
Staying with the 90s, 95, you wrote one called The Psychopathology, Biopsychopathology Factors, Crime Characteristics, and Classification of 25 Homicidal Youth.
Yes.
Staying with the 90s, you wrote one called The Psychopathology and Personality in Juvenile Sexual Homicide Offenders.
Yes.
In 2000, you wrote one with a co-author called Anger, Experience, and Styles of Expression Among Juvenile Sexual Homicide Offenders.
Yes.
Jump forward a little. 2002, I see one, The Sexual Assault of Boys Incarcerated in Jails.
Yes.
In 2005, Personality Comorbidity in Adolescent Females with ADHD.
Yes.
I know you wrote that with others. I'm just trying to move it along, though. There's one that you wrote with somebody else in 2006, The Motivation Behind Serial Sexual Homicide. Is it sex, power, and or control or anger?
Yes.
2008, The Relationship Between Serial Sexual Murder and Autoerotic Asphyxiation.
Yes.
I tried that word twice and didn't get it. Jumping forward a little, 2012, adolescent parricide and psychopathy?
Oh, psychopathy, yes.
Psychopathy, thank you. What's parricide?
The murder of a parent by a child.
You wrote a book as well.
I did, yes.
Which it's hard to get, but I got your book.
It's out of print.
It's out of print, but, you know, someone still had it. It's called Juvenile Sexual Homicide. It's a 2002 book.
Yes.
Right. And you've also contributed in chapters in other books, correct?
I have.
So, for example, Current Perspectives on Conduct Disorder, and that was for the Adolescent Medicine State of the Art Review.
Yes.
Serial Offending in Childhood?
Yes.
The Juvenile Justice System, Delinquency, and the Juvenile Court?
Yes.
So you've written extensively on, seems a lot of your focus is on when juveniles commit crimes. That's a bulk of your work of study, correct?
Really, it's been more in the area of homicide, and often probably the majority of the homicide research I've done has been with children, meaning people under the age of 18.
Who commit homicides?
Yes.
And you're in those articles I've looked at and in your book, you examine the types of maybe common traits or commonalities that might help one, inform one on a child who's growing up that might commit crimes?
Well, yeah, you hope that it would have some impact on predicting it in children to avoid or help cut down on the number of murders in the future. Yes, that would be the ultimate aim.
So there's a couple of the articles, and in fact, in your book, you go through some checklists of the types of those common factors, correct?
Yes.
Pulling out of your book, let's see here.
Can I approach? You may continue, Mr. Wahid. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge. You talked a lot about psychopathy on your direct. There is a thing called a PCLR, correct?
Yes.
And what is that?
That is the psychopathy checklist, and it's 20 items that you rate to get an idea of how much of a criminal personality they have.
And
it's a score of 0 to 40.
And some of those items on the checklist are.
Let me have you approach. All right, Mr. Wahid, you may proceed.
So, again, on direct examination, you discussed psychopathy, correct?
I don't recall that I did.
Did you make any opinion today about connecting psychopathy with what happened in this case?
In the defendant?
Yes.
Did I rate the level of psychopathy in Mr. Farriter?
Nope. Did you say that the types of environment that that Ty was in this situation, that he had at his home, that it has an impact on a child's psychopathy?
As I recall, I used the word psychopathology, meaning mental illness, not psychopathy, something very different.
All right, so the objection sustained. You need to move on, Mr. Wade.
Let me ask you about things you reviewed. You reviewed, so the state provided you a list of items, correct?
Yes.
About 95 pages of items. Included witness statements.
Yes.
When you say witness statements, did that include the statements the witnesses made during the trial?
No.
Did you observe those or read those in any way?
No.
And when I'm saying witnesses, I'm being specific to RF and FF, Ronan and Fiona.
Forgive me, I've been using his first name.
Yes.
Should I say RF?
It can be confusing a little on the names, so I'm going to go with Ronan.
Okay.
So Ronan or Fiona. You did not watch or hear or read those trial testimonies.
What I had was their child protection team interviews, and then his statements to the police in the beginning, and then their depositions I read as well.
Okay. And you were provided by the defense a list of other items electronically. Did you review any of those?
I believe I made it through all of those.
Okay.
A lot of them were repeats of what I had received from the state attorney's office.
Sure, that's possible. So that included Ronan's early childhood records?
Yes.
It included his school records?
Yes.
And that would also be from Basis Academy, correct?
Yes.
And that would also include those emails between the teacher and the parents?
Yes.
You also reviewed disciplinary records from and other school records from Immaculate Heart?
Yes, I did.
You also reviewed clinical summary in April 22 from Kenny Miller?
Yes.
And that was on the reactive attachment disorder issue, correct?
Yes.
You also reviewed the records of Dr. Thomas Rickenbacker?
I did.
You reviewed Ronan's other medical records, pediatric medical records?
Yes.
Did you review any of the photographs?
I did.
Okay. Did you review the Family Counseling Associate records?
Yes.
And there were some other records in there, though, that might go beyond the scope of what you testified to. So if they come up, I'll come back to those.
Okay.
You did not actually evaluate Ronan, correct?
I did not.
And you never asked to evaluate Ronan?
I asked if it was possible, yes, I did.
And what were you told?
Let me have your approach on that.
I can reword it.
Okay, reword it in a way it does involve hearsay.
Sure. Based on the information you received, you then could not evaluate, you believe you could not evaluate Ronan?
True.
All right. And so obviously without actually evaluating Ronan, you can't do anything in terms of diagnosis of him.
Based on the extensive records, my observations of him on the videotapes, teacher observations, et cetera, I believe he has PTSD.
Well, is that your independent diagnosis or based on somebody else's diagnosis?
It's mentioned on occasion in the records, but my independent assessment would be that he does have PTSD, yes.
Well, but as a psychiatrist, is it not correct that you can't, you ethically under the rules are not allowed to make a diagnosis of an individual without actually conducting an examination and an evaluation on your own? Under Section 7.32 of the Principles of Medical Ethics for the American Psychiatric Association Ethics Committee.
It's not a hard and fast rule, and in fact, in forensic psychiatry, sometimes we're asked to review records of someone who has passed away from one reason or another and try to come up and with a diagnostic assessment.
Ronan is not someone who's passed away, though, correct?
Correct.
And when you say it's not a hard and fast rule, it's actually a written rule, though, correct?
Could we go over the language of it?
Sure. In order to arrive at it.
Sustain. Show him what rule you're referring to. You can approach. What was the last part? Oh, this. Let's show it to the state first, and then you can show it to the witness. Thank you, Mr. Wahid. All right, Mr. Wahid, you can continue.
We're going to come back to that question in just a second. Let me talk to you about the pediatric records, which you've reviewed. Let's start with the fact that he was, you've reviewed all these documents, so you know, that he was essentially at 7 months old, dropped off at an orphanage in Vietnam.
Your Honor, I'm not jacked, to be honest, though, with Rockton's
opinion. Overruled, you can answer if you know.
That's what the records show, yes.
Right. And you were talking about, this is in the context of you were talking about how early childhood issues might relate to later development, correct? You were talking about that a couple of times with the state.
Yeah, particularly reactive attachment disorder, yes.
Sure. So we're talking about early childhood. He gets dropped off at 7 months old. We don't know from records, because he was just dropped off at the orphanage, what the prenatal care was, correct? We don't know that.
No, we don't have those records.
We don't know what type of delivery of that baby happened, correct?
Correct.
All right. And we don't really have a medical history for that first 7 months.
That's right.
Okay. Then the child's at the orphanage until about 17 months old, correct?
Yes.
And then he is adopted.
Correct.
By the Ferreters. Correct?
Yes.
Okay. So there's been a lot of conversation about his snacks and eating and that sort of thing. Is it, looking at the 2021 medical records, which was literally the most recent prior to the running away that happened here in Florida, he had a 19.7 BMI, which was considered normal. That's normal, correct?
It's yes. His weight was low, normal, I would say. But in the normal range.
His general appearance presented as well developed, correct?
Yes.
It was noted that he was well nourished and had no acute distress, correct?
And you're reading from the pediatric records?
Yes.
That sounds accurate.
Okay. And I'm picking a particular date of 2021, because I know it changes. I'm not going through all the records, but that was the most recent one, right?
Yes.
Then there was a whole conversation that you had about sugary snacks. Do you remember that?
I don't know if we had a whole conversation about sugary snacks, no.
Well, you definitely talked about snacks with the state, correct?
Yes.
And amongst them were was that he was allegedly being deprived of snacks, correct?
What was the first part of your sentence?
Among the topics you discussed was that Ronan was allegedly being deprived of snacks, correct?
More so meals, I believe we talked about, that sometimes meals would be held if they thought he was angry or if they felt he was misbehaving in some other way, they might withhold a meal.
Okay, so we'll get to meals. Well, you also mentioned snacks, so I just want to go in order. So let me ask you, you reviewed the family counseling records, right? And that goes back, that starts essentially September 23rd of 2015. And Ronan is brought by his parents, and the chief complaint is he gets triggered and angry that he has a low frustration tolerance.
Sustained.
Isn't it true that there were a number of complaints that the parents came to the family counseling services folks with, which included what you were talking about with the RID, which was the hoarding of food, taking food from other kids, that sort of stuff?
Ms. Martin, the counselor said she was considering RAD,
right,
as a diagnosis.
Yeah, so this is now
Kathleen Martin was the counselor.
Correct. I don't want to talk over you, so just when you're done, I'll then go. And in that first visit, though, one of the issues that was or facts that was given to Ms. Martin was this taking food from kids, hoarding food, that issue.
I believe that's in the records. I don't remember the exact timing.
Okay. I'm happy to refresh your memory. It's right in front of me.
Okay.
Yeah.
You can approach Mr. Wade.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
And one of the complaints as well, I feel like I need to give you a copy of this because I'm going to do a lot of walking now. One of the complaints as well initially was that Ronan would actively defy or refuse to comply with requests from authority figures, parents, siblings. Parents and siblings are stressed by the yelling and temper tantrums, right?
Yes.
All right. So as a result of a series of meetings with Ms. Martin, one of the diagnoses that she had made was a thing called oppositional defiant disorder.
You can approach. All right, the objection is sustained. Mr. Wahid, you may continue. We've been going about an hour. Is this a good time to take a break, or you want to go for a little bit longer and tell me what a good stopping off point is?
I can just go for a little longer.
All right. So you tell me when you're at a good break point.
Based on your review of the records, are you aware that that Ronan was also diagnosed at some point with oppositional defiant disorder?
Yes.
And what is that?
It's sort of describes what it is by the title, but it's children who are beyond normal in the sense of defying rules, being oppositional, stubborn, saying things that irritate other people.
And based on what was in the record up until late 2015, would you have agreed with that diagnosis?
I'd really want to know more as to what was going on in his life at that time, and I just don't have the detail to really feel confident on that one way or the other.
Sure. However, would it be enough for you, based on what's in the record, to at least say that that would have been an appropriate differential diagnosis at the time?
Well, there's a lot of reasons kids can be defiant and screaming and going after snacks and sneaking them, that sort of thing, and stealing food from other children at school. So I really want to know more.
All right. So that information, though, based on the record, was passed on to the parents, right? That diagnosis was given to the parents, correct?
I don't know. I assume.
Well, you have it in the records, correct, that you reviewed?
Sustained. If you know, you can answer, sir.
I don't know what Ms. Martin said to the parents about the diagnosis.
Would a document from her report help refresh her recollection?
Well, you asked me if they passed it on to the parents. So,
yes.
If that would help me, yes.
Sustained.
Based on your review of the records, was there any advice given as to how to handle that diagnosis?
Objection, hearsay. Sustained. Let me have you approach on that, Mr. Waheed. Objection sustained. You may continue, Mr. Waheed.
If hypothetically a child's diagnosed with ODD, What would you recommend to parents as treatment?
Objection, relevance.
The hypothetical.
Sustained. Even a hypothetical still has to be relevant. So unless you want to argue the relevancy, sidebar, you can move on.
I would like to do that.
All right, so let's approach again. All right, the objection is withdrawn. Do you need the question restated for you, sir?
I'll just
go ahead and restate it.
What would be the treatment you would recommend for ODD, oppositional defiance disorder?
In general, learning as much as you can about the ODD symptoms and where they're happening and what's happening, and is it happening everywhere or is it happening just at home? How long has it been occurring? And then once you kind of get a real understanding of it, then it might be approached with individual therapy or just be meeting with a child, or you might be doing a parent training and working with the parents, and or you might also do family sessions where you'd meet with the child and the parents to work on the oppositional defiant behavior. And sometimes if it's really problematic and you're not getting anywhere with those treatments, you could consider medications.
A medication like is it Clondine? It's a
Clonidine.
Clonidine.
Possibly, yes. You could try that.
Okay.
Yes.
And is your understanding that was ever tried on Ronan?
That was tried for, I believe, ADHD.
But it was tried on him.
Yes. And sometimes children who are depressed will show ODD type symptoms, so you might end up treating them for depression and using an antidepressant.
And would limit setting be one of the things that you would recommend when treating a child with ODD, that parents have limit setting where they put limits on the child?
Yes, that may well be part of it, yes.
And I'm not sure if you said it, but also would therapy sessions be a part of that?
And generally, yes.
Would you take steps to reduce sugar or other types of caffeinated things that would make one more hyper?
That's very rarely going to explain ODD. I mean, could that be a small part of it? Maybe. But that isn't going to be the source of a child coming in with ODD symptoms.
You said a moment ago that at some point that Dr. Martin, in the review of the records, had also come to a conclusion later on in her work that there's a possibility of reactive attachment disorder. Correct?
It was mentioned, but I read through the records. They're a little bit vague, but yet she had a couple hour-long sessions with Ronan alone, and she described him as compliant, cooperative, normal speech, insightful, judgment intact, adequate impulse control, good memory.
Are you reading from a particular document?
That's from her notes from November 4th of 2015. So what he didn't come across at all as having ODD in these, she had two, I believe, 60-minute individual sessions with him. He came across as very sort of really in a lot of ways unremarkable as far as having mental illness symptoms of an ODD nature.
But in that same November 4th, 2015, isn't it correct that she also pointed out he was eating too many sugars and sweets and that the parents had to, and that this was leading to emotionally liable behavior, and that the parents, including screaming, tantrums, and that the parents eventually, she opines that they need to monitor his diet, correct? I'm summarizing without reading the document.
That sounds correct, yes.
Okay.
But again, eating some sugary sweets isn't going to explain that diagnosis.
We can take a break at this time, Judge.
Okay. All right, we're going to take a 10-minute break. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, Mark, if you could escort them back. Actually, we'll take a 15-minute break. It's 2:45, and we'll be in recess until 3. All right, everyone may be seated. All right, court will be in recess until 3 o'clock.
There's more to come.
Kid in a Cage. Florida versus Timothy Ferriter from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Press subscribe now.
Hi, Uncle Laser here.
America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Boto Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto. It's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino. Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
10 hours on my feet, traffic, noise, everybody needing something from me. My head is spinning. I just need the world to stop for 1 second. But then I get home, shoes off, phone out, and I open Modo Casino. Hundreds of slots, classic table games. It's my instant reset. The variety I want in the quiet I need.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details. Download the Modo Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Modo Casino. America's social casino. Modo Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Modo Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Modo Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Modo Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Modo Casino app today.
John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spend on Modo Casino. Modo's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily. And the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Modo, America's social casino. Play for free on Modo.us.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details. Download the Modo Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Modo Casino. America's social casino.
John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spend on Modo Casino. Modo's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily. And the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Modo, America's social casino. Play for free on Modo.us.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details. Download the Modo Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Modo Casino. America's social casino.
Hours on my feet, traffic, noise, everybody needing something from me. My head is spinning. I just need the world to stop for 1 second. But then I get home, shoes off, phone out, and I open Modo Casino. Hundreds of slots, classic table games. It's my instant reset. The variety I want in the quiet I need.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details. Download the Modo Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Modo Casino. America's social casino.
Identity theft can cost more than you think. Drained investment accounts, stolen tax returns, lost wages, expenses for lawyers. It's a lot. That's why LifeLock is backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, which covers up to $1 million each for stolen funds, fees for experts and lawyers, and out-of-pocket expenses. Don't face the burden of identity theft alone. Protect your future and finances with LifeLock. Join now and save up to 30% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.